This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 19th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ryan Devereaux, The Guardian newspaper on Occupy Wall Street, the six-month anniversary. Police came out in force, multiple instances of brutality. Also on the program to give us a first-hand account and also to explain to us how spring has sprung in the American spring. Jeff Smith. Also of, of the media team at Occupy Wall Street. Also on the program today, new reporting on just how close President Obama and the Democrats were to selling all of us out on Social Security. Pensions, the next target, ongoing target of the 1%, your pensions. And, of course, we'll touch on in the better half of the program the incredible story that Mike Daisy, the one who the person who basically alerted us to what was going on at Foxconn in China with the way that our iPads and iPhones are constructed in these factories. Apparently, much of his story or some of his story embellished. And the Coney guy, we'll talk about that in the better half of the program. But first, I want to touch on this. I don't have much to add to what's being reported at this point, but I wanted to make sure that people were aware of this story. And we'll put some links up on majority.fm to this story. A horrible, horrible story where these incredible gun laws that are being passed around the country, particularly in southern states, some, I guess, in the Midwest, these stand down or stand your ground laws, which essentially says that you can carry a concealed weapon and simply widens the parameters in which you're allowed to shoot. And it's not simply these laws. Of course, it creates a certain culture. And usually the victims in these instances are not only innocent, but are more often than not people who society already has a predisposition towards sort of suspecting. In this case, it is a case of what I think should be, frankly, not a homicide, a manslaughter charge. We're going to see, so far we've seen nothing. A 17-year-old kid, Trayvon Martin, African-American kid, was staying with his dad and went out on the night of the NBA All-Star game to go get snacks at a 7-Eleven or Stewart's or whatever, one of those convenience stores. He's walking back And I guess either cutting through a gated community or walking by a gated community.
I think the father's house was actually in the gated community.
Walking to the gated community where his, I believe his father lived. In the suburb of Sanford near, in Florida. And a call is put into 911 by the head of a neighborhood watch, who apparently is carrying a gun.
It's actually also important to add that he's the only member of the neighborhood watch because he's the only one who wanted it.
So this is a guy who's obviously very excited at the prospect of playing policeman. And he calls into the cops and says, I see a guy, he's walking around, African-American, looks like he's up to no good. He's got his hand in his pants or something. And it's sort of raining, and he's sort of looking around, walking. And the police said, all right, we'll come and check it out. And then you can hear the guy leave his car because the wind starts to rush in on his cell phone, so much so that the police dispatch says, are you walking? Are you following him? And the guy's like, yeah. And he said, okay, don't do that. And the next thing you know, minutes pass, and there are 911 recordings of you hear someone screaming. And then all of a sudden you hear a single shot. And the 17-year-old boy, Trayvon Martin, is killed. He has no weapon. A couple of packs of candy, some soda or whatever it is, iced tea. And the police, it seems, barely question this Zimmerman. They don't bring him in. They don't give him an alcohol breathalyzer. He has gotten no charges at this point. There are reports that when the police question witnesses, one witness, a woman apparently, said that she heard the kid screaming. And the police kept saying, No, you heard Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch guy. And she said, the kid. And they kept saying, no, Zimmerman. And she finally said, okay, Zimmerman. And now she has come out to say, I never was referring to that guy. I didn't know the names of the people. The cops just kept saying this guy's name. And so I assumed that was it. And so what we have here is a police department, which I think is going to get a lot more scrutiny in the way that they handled this case, a case on its face that seems completely unjust, and it being the function of a law which, if not encourages this behavior, doesn't discourage it. It's an unbelievable case. We'll put links up on the site, but I wanted to make sure. I don't have anything to add beyond that, but it's something I want to draw your attention to. Because we have a real problem in this country with this, with the militarization of our police and these gun laws, which are encouraging people who essentially, you know, fancy themselves Rambo to go out there. This guy's upset because there's been some break-ins and he doesn't want another one of these a-holes, I think is the quote, to get away. Just reprehensible. And now this 17-year-old kid, who by all accounts is just a good kid, dead now. I hope every one of those legislators who voted for this bill realize that they bear responsibility in this instance. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Devereaux of The Guardian.
Last night, she said, oh, baby, I feel so
Hey, folks, this episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. It's the internet's leading provider of audiobooks. They've got more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers, great books, including Michael Hastings' The Operators, the wild and terrifying inside story of America's war in Afghanistan. You can go right now and get a free Audible downloadable book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick up that Michael Hastings books. They've got hundreds of thousands of other titles. You can't go wrong. It's free, folks. I walk out that door, but I've been in town for just now 50 minutes now. I feel so down, and I don't know why. I keep walking for miles. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Ryan Devereaux of the Guardian newspaper. Ryan, where are you right now?
I'm at the courthouse here in New York City waiting for Occupy Wall Street protester Cecily McMillan to appear before the judge. McMillan has received a lot of attention here recently after videos surfaced of her detained by police officers on Saturday night after protesters were moved out of Ducati Park. She's in handcuffs and appears to suffer from a seizure on the ground while she's detained. And the videos have been widely circulated and have been discussed pretty extensively and caused a lot of concern among Occupy protesters here.
Now, so she was cuffed. She was having a seizure. Was she asking for medical attention?
Well, we haven't been able to confirm that she had a seizure because attorneys with the National Lawyers Guild haven't been able to speak to her since she was taken into custody. It's been a real struggle with the attorneys here trying to get, you know, trying to actually talk to her and find out what happened. The NYPD said that they used the phrase apparent seizure. So we're unclear exactly what her medical conditions were. As far as whether she was asking for medical attention, that's hard to tell from any of the videos. And one would suspect that while she was convulsing, that she wasn't asking for medical attention. But you can hear from the multiple videos that were shot of from the scene, you know, onlookers screaming for the police to do something. And from what I've gathered, it took approximately 17 minutes, maybe as long as 23 minutes for an ambulance to arrive to the scene, which has concerned a lot of people because while there were scores of police officers on the ground Saturday night, there were no paramedics in sight. And a lot of people have are really troubled by that fact.
And I guess also another question to be resolved is at what point it became apparent, if the police are saying that there was an apparent seizure, one has to wonder at what point it became apparent to them there was a seizure that was taking place, and why didn't they act upon it at that moment?
Right. That's the question that a lot of people are asking, because when you watch the footage, it's pretty apparent to onlookers that something very serious is happening to this young woman. She's laying on the ground. She's jerking about, and she has her hands flexed cuffed behind her back. It didn't take any time for people to realize that there was there were serious concerns there. I spoke to a EMT who was an EMT from Florida who was on hand that night, who was, you know, watching the protest. He was across the street and had a straight line of sight to McMillan. He told me that he was appalled by the way the situation was handled. A number of other witnesses said that her head was bouncing up and down on the concrete, and the paramedics said that she could have easily died in that situation. You know, people were very concerned about the fact that her head didn't seem to be stabilized at any point during the time when she was convulsing. There are a lot of real issues.
And let's I want to back up and we just go over what you witnessed on Saturday night as this was the 6-month anniversary of Occupy, and there was essentially a crowds that amassed in Zuccotti Park. And when we talk about what happened and to this woman, the broader issue here is that there is a pattern by the New York City Police Department that has been treating protesters in such a way that in the rare instances where someone has a seizure, because of the way that they're treating people, you can have a serious medical situation happen. But tell me what you saw on Saturday.
Well, Saturday was a really interesting day where emotions sort of swung back and forth between people being really excited, you know, to be back in the park and speaking to each other, you know, people meeting, talking about politics. Some of the really positive aspects about Zuccotti Park were on, and Liberty Park is a Liberty Square, as the occupiers like to call it, were on full display. You know, people were coming together. They were enjoying each other's company. They were talking about issues. But at the same time, there was a lot of tension in the air, too. It started at about 4 in the afternoon when the police moved in and tried to clear protesters off of a public sidewalk and arrested roughly 6 or 7 in the process. And throughout the day, there was sort of this unease that something could happen. And at about 11:30 in the evening, a man who said he was representing the security company that works for Brookfield Properties, which owns Zuccotti Park, made an announcement by megaphone that the protesters had violated the rules of the park by setting up structures and bringing in sleeping equipment, sleeping gear and camping equipment, told them that they had to leave the park. He was drowned out by chants of "We are not afraid," "Whose park? Our park," those sorts of things. And Brookfield left, and then the police moved in shortly thereafter, scores of police officers. No way to tell the numbers, but I mean dozens upon dozens, rows upon rows of police officers moved into the park, and the protesters were gathered there in the middle. They had their limbs locked together, sitting nonviolently, and the police began pulling people out of the area in a fashion that just about everyone who witnessed it described as incredibly violent. And I've covered Occupy protests since the beginning, and I've spoken to a lot of people who have been at these protests since the beginning, and the consensus seems to be that this was one of, if not the most violent incidents in the history of Occupy Wall Street in New York City.
Did you see any police swinging batons?
I didn't personally see any batons swung. I would be surprised if that sort of thing happened. I saw, a protester thrown into a glass door, leaving a massive crack in the door. And the photo from that incident has been widely circulated online. Had multiple reports from people saying that they were punched in the face, or they watched people get punched in the face. Protesters saying that they saw protesters with their with police boots on their head. A number of protesters were taken into a city bus, about 17 of them, according to one protester who was managing to tweet and send text messages from inside the bus. He said that a protester had a boot mark on his face. This protester who was tweeting claimed that he was bleeding out of his ear, that his jaw was fractured, that his thumb was broken. It was a pretty disturbing scene by most accounts. There were also reports of, you know, police officers directly threatening protesters. There was a real sense of intimidation between the police and the protesters. Being as the police were, you know, intimidating the protesters, and I don't think it was the other way around. The National Lawyers Guild folks that I've spoken to have noted that the amount of people hospitalized as a result of Saturday's crackdown is larger than they think that they can remember so far in the history of Occupy Wall Street. And the charges that are being leveled against protesters are also more serious. Charges of resisting arrest, which some civil rights attorneys say sometimes means resisting arrest, but also sometimes means getting beat up by the police.
Do you have a number on how many people were hospitalized over the weekend?
From what I've gathered, it is at least 5 and maybe more. 5, potentially 6 or more, but definitely at least 5.
My understanding is that the police were also rather aggressive with the press. You had an incident, is that right?
It should be said that there were officers who made an effort. It was a clear effort to try to understand, you know, who had a credentialed press act and give them access and that sort of thing. But there were numerous incidents where, members of the media weren't respected. I interviewed a photographer who had a bruised arm from a police officer that was trying to get him out of the way. I personally was trying to cross a one-lane street that wasn't being used by cars or anything. I was just trying to cross to go over to interview a couple of bagpipe players who actually were accosted by the police. And this officer stepped in front of me and told me I couldn't. And I said, I'm a journalist here. You know, I have a press pass. And he just straight up told me, I don't care. And then this same officer made a similar remark to me later in the evening as the police were moving into the park, clearing everybody out. I had been given permission to stand in the area that I was in by two other senior officers. And so I thought I was good. And then I feel this hand on my arm. He turns me around and told me that he didn't give a F about my credentials or press pass or permission that I received to be in the area. It goes both ways. I do think some officers are trying to clean up their behavior when it comes to dealing with the press. It seems to me that order, has gone through the ranks to some extent, but it's not something that's resonated with everybody in the department, that's for sure.
And just to be clear, your press pass is issued by the NYPD, is that right?
That's correct. And covering Occupy Wall Street before, I was actually not working with NYPD credentials, so I've kind of been on both sides and recently received a NYPD press pass. So, in New York City, in order to get a press pass, you have to appeal basically to the police department, show them a body of work that indicates that you have been covering emergency type of situations where you have to cross police lines, that sort of thing. You know, a certain number within a year or so. It's quite the ordeal sometimes to get a hold of these press passes.
And so how many people were in the park as of 11:30 Saturday night?
It's hard to say. There were dozens gathered there in the middle of the park with their arms locked. As I said, maybe 40 to 50 actually, committing civil disobedience and staying in the park. Well, civil disobedience might be debatable since there are questions of whether or not they could have legally been evicted from the area that they were in, given that it's a public space. But about 50 or so holding their ground there, and then, several hundred people in the area around the perimeter of the park watching what was going on. The numbers were pretty high on Saturday, compared to recent Occupy-related events and demonstrations.
And what do you think accounts for that? That just the people were excited to come out for the 6-month anniversary. Is it the weather? Is it from your sense of reporting on this over the past six, I guess, months or so now, that that there's sort of the movement is coming out of, at least I know there's been activity in terms of specific actions, but in terms of broader protests, is there a sense that there is a push now by organizers to have a sort of a coming out this spring?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a number of the factors that you just mentioned. I mean, Saturday was a beautiful day. It was really nice out, and it was the 6-month anniversary, and people were excited. And Occupy Wall Street organizers have been, putting in a good amount of work over the winter, to sort of shape new actions and that sort of thing. But I think the real reason probably that people came out is that the conditions that precipitated Occupy Wall Street in the first place still exist, the same social and economic conditions that people were upset about 6 months ago still exist. And that's what the protest is supposed to be about. It's about, economic inequality and the concentration of wealth and power within a small segment of the population. And that seems to still be the world that we're living in. And I think as long as that's the case, Occupy Wall Street is going to, continue to find support.
How many people are you aware? How many people were arrested in total on Saturday?
The NYPD says 73 people were arrested. Other estimates have been higher, but as far as we know, officially from the police department, 73.
And are they all having hearings this morning at the courthouse?
No, it's been kind of a mess in terms of hearings and arraignments and that sort of thing. A number of protesters were released yesterday, but it seems that a significant portion are still being held, and you know, some are just released, and some are going to have to, you know, follow up with further court appearances.
Have you heard any reports of bail bonds being the amount being increased if those arrested do not agree to have an iris scan? We've heard reports of that.
I don't know that bail has been increased for people specifically because they refuse. It's an iris photograph. But there have been some noticeably high bails set for protesters for charges that are generally considered not too serious. We're talking about like $1,000 bail sets for disorderly conduct, for example. That sort of thing is not typical, but we have been seeing it as a result of Saturday's arrest. And as I may have mentioned before, we're seeing a lot of these resisting arrest charges. So the way in which they're being dealt with legally is different than what we've seen in the past, they being the protesters.
Have you done any reporting as to what may account for that? In other words, with this increased violence by the police, with the increase in bail being set at higher amounts, of the charges being sort of ratcheted up a little bit, is there a sense that the city is nervous about the reemergence of Occupy Wall Street? Is there a sense that the police may be trying to drain Occupy Wall Street funds, which have been reported as starting to dwindle a little bit? Do you know anything about?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's an interesting way to look at it, and I haven't read any reporting or seen anything that confirms that that is in fact the case, but that idea is certainly floating around Occupy circles that, you know, there's a reason why the city seems to really be pushing back against this what is being perceived as a reemergence of Occupy Wall Street. So, time will tell in terms of the motivations for why people were charged with what they were charged with, why bails were set, where they were set, but we shall see. It is very interesting the way that New York City is responding to Occupy Wall Street, you know, after Saturday.
Ryan Devereaux of The Guardian, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Smith, get a perspective on the weekend's events and the events going forward from one of the occupiers themselves. We'll be right back after this. I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way of slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah. Yeah. And you wasn't alone. It hit me like a ton. You hit me like a ton. No, no, no. Oh yeah. Well, I turned my feelings on. I turned my feelings on the side. Yeah, yeah. Like I'm gonna ignite. I saw them stars go off. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. We have Jeff Smith from the media team of Occupy Wall Street. Also, I want to remind you all the videos and pictures that we referenced in the interview with Ryan Devereaux will be on majority.fm now. And Ryan, we just spoke to Ryan Devereaux, who is at the courthouse awaiting the, I guess, the hearing for Cecily McMillan, who was a woman reportedly to have had a seizure while having her hands cuffed behind her, and the police did not react somewhere between 17 and 23 minutes before they got an ambulance for her. Jeff, welcome to the program. Did you see that incident?
I did see the incident. In fact, I was standing as the first confrontation happened with her when the police grabbed her, and it was like, you know, it looked like four or five police all on top of her, you know, pummeling her, essentially. I mean, it was really kind of a Rodney King sort of moment when they were attacking this tiny little girl. And then after they had already cuffed her and put her on a city bus that they had commandeered, that's when she started having seizures and convulsing. And so they pulled her off of the bus and just laid her down on the sidewalk. And, you know, like you said, it was a good 15 or 20 minutes at least where she was just kind of writhing on the street and the cops were just milling around. And, you know, it really looked like they didn't care. It was really odd.
So this isn't there's no way to make the argument that the police weren't aware of this. They actually reacted to her seizure by simply pulling her off the bus. That was their reaction, period.
Correct. And to lay her on the ground and, you know, her head wasn't even supported. I mean, some people saw her head kind of bouncing on the sidewalk as she was convulsing. It was disturbing. And people were shouting at the police, you know, are you going to do something? What are you doing? And they would just literally, you know, kind of check their watches and pace around. It was disturbing.
You know, there's a notion out there floating around that she elbowed a cop. You know, I don't know if you supposedly witnessed it. People have slowed down the video. They didn't see that. But I'm very curious as to the argument as this woman elbowed a police officer 25 minutes ago. Now she's in the midst of the seizure, so we'll just let her head smash against the floor of the street while she writhes in sort of a semi-delirious state. Do you know anything about the supposed elbowing?
I don't know anything specifically, and again, to me, that sort of sounds like a Rodney King statement. Like, we see them beating on him for 20 minutes, and supposedly there was some rationale or reason that they had to do that.
Right.
I don't know exactly what it is. So the idea that somehow, you know, a 120-pound woman was in any way a threat to, you know, five full-grown policemen, I don't really understand that. So the idea that somehow, even if she did somehow do something wrong, it's the police's job to have restraint and not, you know, punch back, so to speak. And so the idea that even that their actions were justified in any way, I think, seems ludicrous.
What else did you witness on Saturday night? I've heard all sorts of different reports. New York Times outlines a couple of different reports of police brutality, as far as I can tell. Was there anything else that you witnessed firsthand?
Yeah, I mean, when they first came into the park, it was definitely very similar or shades of the Zuccotti eviction back in November. You know, the difference being that there were people actually standing around to watch it this time. But the way that they just, you know, manhandled people and grabbed skulls and, you know, threw them down on the ground, or when you just saw cops, you know, literally with their boot heels on people's faces, things like that, it just made no sense. And it really felt like leading up throughout the day, they had been instigating certain skirmishes, sort of, you know, cordoning off a section of the crowd. You know, on St. Patrick's Day, when there's crowds everywhere and basically nobody's trying to get anywhere in New York City, they would just create a situation where the cops would sort of kettle off a group of people, and then people would start pushing, and then they'd start arresting people. And that happened repeatedly throughout the afternoon leading into the evening. And then it was really, you know, when people started gathering into the park in large numbers after the Left Forum emptied out. And the idea was that people wanted to stay there all night. And
Now we should make it clear that you're allowed to stay overnight in Zuccotti Park. You're just not allowed to sleep there.
Correct. And so they've done this in the past, you know, similar sort of thing on New Year's Eve, where they just declare the park has to be closed for sanitation reasons or, you know, somehow Brookfield is able to make that call now and the police act on their orders. And it really seems like it's arbitrary when they can just decide, okay, now you've had enough fun. Now we're going to violently, you know, clear this park out. And so when people decided to sit and, you know, defy those orders, that's really when the violence ensued. And, you know, it's really hard to understand what the police strategy is for this, but it seems like in the same way that there's definitely a renewed energy that's just come from the springtime, and I think people are excited to get back out to do this, it feels like the police are doing their part also to escalate this and turn it back into something that was much bigger than it was previously. And so, again, I'm feeling like this is not deterring anyone. This is actually just fortifying everyone's resolve. And after having gone through the court system and realizing, you know, what they're charging people and the fact that none of these charges are really sticking on anyone, and even, you know, overnight, there were about 17 people that were released at about 3 a.m. that had been held for over 24 hours, and they were just released with no charge whatsoever. So essentially the police arrested them and held them and then just let them go without charging them. In some circles that's considered kidnapping, but, you know, it shows the degree to which they will use arrest as a tool to try and curb this movement, even when there isn't really any legal basis for it.
Speculate, if you will, if you're comfortable doing so. I mean, do you think that there's a concerted effort by the police to crack down harder, to make these sort of, I don't know if I would call them arrests, but just sort of these random detentions and levying ever-increasing charges? I've heard reports that the bail is that they're requiring is being raised. Is there an attempt by the city, do you think, at this point in the Bloomberg administration to sort of nip this in the bud, as it were?
It definitely feels like there's some. I mean, within the last month, I believe the judge was changed that's handling all the Occupy cases. There was one judge up until February that I saw, and then the new judge apparently has been much more strict in terms of setting higher bails and in general has been much more hostile towards protesters. And so you have to wonder who is involved in switching out these judges. And, you know, I just have to think that Bloomberg and Ray Kelly, and at the highest levels, they're definitely coordinating this. This is not just low-level police officers acting on their own. And, you know, I just think that they probably think this is the best way to do it, try and scare people, make sure people won't come out. And to a certain degree, it's working. I mean, I think there are some people that are scared of arrest and police brutality. And so, you know, I mean, I hate to say that it's working, but I think on some level, you know, that's the police state trying to scare people, and it is working. I mean, it's sort of similar to what they've done with the war on terror, and just create so much fear that you relent to the powers and just stay inside and don't step up and speak out.
What of the reports that the Occupy Wall Street funds are starting to dwindle a little bit? There's been a suggestion that perhaps these higher bails are a function of trying to drain those resources. What can you tell me about that?
I could see that would be an attempt. I mean, we do have $100,000 that's been dedicated to the bail fund solely. So when you hear that the money's running out or is almost gone, that doesn't include $100,000. And plus, we have had bail money that has been posted for previous trials that is now starting to come back as well, because when you show up for court, you obviously get your bail money back. So to me, it's not as much of a concern, particularly on the bail side. Also, you know, financially overall, Occupy Wall Street has never really actively solicited any fundraising. And so when you see groups like Move On and another, you know, progressive organizations continuing to use Occupy Wall Street for their own fundraising, you still see the power that it has to actually raise funds. So I think in the months ahead, when there is an actual need or we express an actual effort to raise funds, I think we'll be able to do it again. But in the meantime, I actually think it's been helpful to go through this process and understand that there are certain elements of money that are really corrosive to an organization. And so keeping a certain amount just for bail and legal issues aside, you know, I think that money is perhaps not the most important thing to make this organization go. And in fact, maybe trying to operate on little or no money is what this movement needs right now. So, I mean, I think that it's been a great lesson, honestly, for a movement that is built on trying to end capitalism and reform a system that's been bought by money, to understand how money itself can even, you know, hurt our movement. And so I see them all really as positives. And in the future, I'm sure money will be there. This is really, as most people know, the best hope that America kind of has going in terms of actual real change and effective reform to the system.
So what can we expect in the coming weeks in terms of the American Spring? I was over at 99solidarity.net, there's I'm seeing more and more of this use of the names American Spring. What can we what should we anticipate in the next month or so?
Well, I think you're going to see a couple of things. One thing, you're definitely going to see an attempt at a co-optation of this movement for the purposes of the Democratic Party and the re-election of Barack Obama. And so you're going to see a lot of the language of American Spring, 99%, all these things. And you're going to have to be kind of careful as to who's exactly putting out this message. And know that the real sort of authentic grassroots movement is always going to be just as critical of the Democratic Party and really all electoral politics as a unit. So, you know, I would just say take it with a grain of salt when you see some things coming in the spring. But by the same token, the real, you know, grassroots spark that built this movement in the fall is still here. And really the problems that precipitated it are just as bad now as ever. So the idea that somehow this is a passing fad, I think you're going to see kids now that are even more willing and ready come spring and summer to lay their bodies on the line and to become a part of this. I think what we've had here is a real, almost cultural shift, that now protesting has become something that's a little bit more acceptable, or at least not foreign to a new generation of young people. And I think now you're going to start to see them, you know, dipping their toe in, so to speak, and becoming part of this. And, you know, even on St. Patrick's Day at 4 a.m. after, you know, all the arrests and the wild marches and the scene, there were people with, you know, shamrock shirts on that were just there for St. Patrick's Day that hung out and are now interested in being part of Occupy Wall Street. And so what I think you're really going to see is just a true continuance of the building that started in the fall. And, you know, you don't really know where it's going to go, but it's definitely got a momentum that's building. I've definitely felt it for the last couple of weeks now.
And lastly, it's been a couple of weeks since we spoke, but since that time, there was a story in the Times about the extensive police surveillance and spying that has been taking place, and sort of harassment even outside of the context of the protests of different members of Occupy. Is the movement doing anything to deal with that, or is it just, you know, we'll just continue to be transparent, and when that happens, that happens?
No, I mean, it's definitely something that we're concerned with, and, you know, the idea of being transparent is certainly in line with the fact that we don't really think that we're doing anything illegal. But by the same token, there has been definitely discussion of potentially hiring our own private investigators or having people to actually surveil our surveyors, because, you know, aside from the actual anecdotal evidence that I've gotten from lots of people, you see what was clearly uncovered by the AP on the spying on Muslims, and you have to imagine that there's no reason that he wouldn't take every liberty to try and step on our rights in the same way. So, you know, aside from the stories that you saw in that article, you know, there was another instance of a woman before the December 17th action, the Duarte Square reoccupation, where 10 plainclothes cops just showed up at her apartment because people were going to film, you know, in an apartment that overlooked that square. And she was really scared, and they threatened to throw her out of her apartment. And, you know, I know she didn't even appear in any of the articles because she was so worried about that, but there's some really scary stuff that's going on.
They threatened to throw her out of the apartment for attempted videotaping? Is that basically it?
Basically, what happened was is that, you know, she was at attending a planning meeting of some sort and said, hey, I've got an apartment that overlooks that Duarte Square. You could probably set up a camera to film if you wanted to.
Wow.
And the next thing she knows, she's at her apartment and her landlord is, you know, at her door with 10 plainclothes cops saying, if you have anything to do with Occupy Wall Street, you'll be out on the street. And she got scared, and I don't blame her.
I've
even heard, you know, even on Saturday, I know someone that a cop, one of the white shirt commanding officers came up to and said, hey, I know your name. Watch out. I'm going to get you today. And, you know, he was like, I'm not getting arrested today. I'll see you guys later. And it's that kind of tactics and that sort of thing that I think is going to continue to be used. And, you know, it's troubling, to say the least.
Wow. Jeff Smith, thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. All right, folks. Now we will head into the better half of the program, wherein you can call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Michael Moore had a piece the other day it's coming out in April's edition of The Nation. The purpose of Occupy Wall Street is to occupy Wall Street. In the better half of the program, talk about this story about the grand bargain. We'll take your phone call, 646-257-3920. I guess we'll also mention the Puerto Rican primary or caucus. Shocking. But Santorum, after telling them all to give up Spanish and just learn English, I guess, lost. Wow. It's really weird. It's too bad he can't head back to Iowa and tell them not to grow corn. It's unbelievable. All right, you can IM me at Majority FM. Also, folks, if you can, please become a member. I don't know, supposedly the economy is getting better, but not for a lot of our members. People going through some very hard times. So if you are not one of those going through a difficult period financially and enjoy this program a couple of times a week, two or three times a week, five times a week, why not support it so that it can continue? You can also, of course, buy your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at Support the Show at majority.fm. Coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. Donate your account at donateyouraccount.com. There's one more way for you to help support the program. Spend 20 minutes. Come noodle around our site at majority.fm. Find out how you can support the program. All right. See you in the better half.